President Biden is heading to Canada for one day, a quick trip with a big agenda.
The Canadians would like it to be a longer visit. They'd like to do more things, but it's been a kind of rush job.
Also today, on the ground, they're enemies, but in space, Russia and the U.S. are cooperating to get their astronauts back to Earth. It is tricky.
What we do in space, what any country does in space, is really a reflection of sort of the political power dynamics that are happening here on Earth.
I'm Marco Werman, and 20 years on, an American veteran of the Iraq War looks back. She says the U.S. military needs to remember the long echo of its operations.
The costs of these wars are very acutely being experienced, not just by those of us who went, but by our children.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. It's hard to believe that it's been 20 years since the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. For the past few weeks on the show, we've been looking back at the legacy of that war from various perspectives. Many of the 160,000 coalition troops who were deployed for the invasion are also looking back, remembering and reliving those tumultuous events. Among them, Kayla Williams. She's a former U.S. Army sergeant who was part of the Iraq mission in 2003 as an Arabic linguist. She's also written about her experiences in the book, Love My Rifle More Than You. Kayla Williams joins us from Reston, Virginia. Hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Take us back to 2003, if you would. Who were you and where was your head at before deployment?
So by the time we were preparing to cross into the berm, I really felt like I was in a Dr. Seuss book where the waiting place is the worst place to be. Nobody wants to go to war, but somehow going into Iraq seemed better than continuing to sit around and wait, not knowing what was going to happen. I'd spent so long training, 63 weeks learning Arabic and then additional time learning to do my job and use our equipment. And I think we were all just ready to go, despite having heard really dire prognostications about what we might face. We were in chemical protectant gear. We really believed at that moment that we might be exposed to chemical weapons, and we wore that gear for weeks.
So how did you feel about the invasion of Iraq when you received orders to deploy?
I didn't think that the reasons we were being given seemed reasonable, but when you're in the military, you don't vote on whether or not you go to war. You trust that the American people have voted for folks who will make the right decisions.
You followed orders, though. Looking back 20 years later, how did the experience of being in Iraq change you and your opinions about the war?
My experiences taught me a lot about who I am and who I want to be. And some of those lessons came from the moments when I did not live up to my own values, not speaking up to stop detainee abuse when I witnessed it, for example. That really shaped my commitment in the long term to living an ethical life and doing what I can to make things better for those coming after me as veterans and in other ways. It's hard to look back and know that I didn't always make the right decision, and to know that our entire nation making the bad decision to go to war has led to so much pain and suffering and death.
Yeah, help us understand some of those experiences, Kayla, like witnessing the abuse of Iraqi detainees. How did that impact you over the long run?
It was hard to sit with the knowledge that I had not stayed true to my own values in that moment, that although I refused to continue participating, I didn't blow the whistle the way somebody with a lot more moral courage than I have did at Abu Ghraib later. And folks need to know the risk that people under them will feel this pressure to get information at any cost and guard against that.
Do you think those lessons have been taken on board by Washington?
No. I think that the U.S. populace has been sucked into some belief that by any means necessary is still the right way to go about things. And that persists despite all the lessons to the contrary that we've seen come out of it. And it's just incredibly depressing.
Kayla, you met your husband, retired U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Brian McGuff, in Iraq 5 months after you met. Brian was riding through Mosul when the bus he was in hit an IED. What's your most vivid memory of that time?
I was at our forward operating base up in Tal Afar, and we got news that the convoy had been hit, that Brian had been evacuated by helicopter to Baghdad, where I later learned he had neurosurgery in a tent. I was helping wash out the gear of a fellow soldier in my unit, get the blood out of it. You know, this was when we were still very naively confused at why the local populace was turning on us, and our own anger and resentment that people were trying to kill us when we were there to bring freedom and democracy. That was really, you know, a confusing time, but a time also when it was just impossible for me to not feel angry at the local people, given that people I knew were getting hurt.
Were you surprised at your reaction?
At the time, I wasn't reflective enough to be surprised by my reaction. And with the time to separate emotionally a bit, I was only surprised that we didn't see it coming, right? Like, I grew up in the era of watching movies like Red Dawn, and you root for the insurgents in that movie, right? Mm. So, of course, this is what happened. Of course, the local people did not want a foreign military setting up checkpoints on their roads and breaking into their houses in the middle of the night.
You alluded earlier to the Iraqis and working on their behalf, but also your anger after your husband was injured in that IED explosion. How do you think that experience changed your husband?
He sustained a penetrating traumatic brain injury from shrapnel, and it led to post-traumatic stress disorder, cognitive impairments, memory problems, emotional challenges that we've been living with ever since. Troops were also surviving with injuries that would have absolutely killed anyone in previous conflicts. Brian's injuries would have been fatal, even I think as recently as the first Gulf War. And we all had to learn so much about how to support troops with those injuries, how to support their caregivers. We have spent 18 years now recovering from that moment and trying to find a new path forward and take care of each other, take care of our kids.
I can imagine that you weren't expecting any of that. I mean, how do you now understand the long-term toll of the war, psychological and physical?
The cost of the wars is estimated into the trillions of dollars, but I also think of it in much more personal costs. So a few years ago, my husband had a seizure related to the brain injury, and our daughter was sitting with him when it happened and saw her daddy scream and fall down. And she was seven, and it was absolutely terrifying for her. And so for me, the costs of these wars are very acutely being experienced, not just by those of us who went, but by our children.
Does that cost ever diminish or dissipate for you or the people around you?
The last surviving dependent of a Civil War veteran who was receiving a pension died in 2020 at age 90. That was 155 years after the Civil War ended.
Yeah. Kayla, there's been a lot said this week about how many Americans have moved on from the war in Iraq. If you had to leave us with one lesson from the Iraq invasion, what would it be?
I would like all Americans, and particularly elected officials, to truly think about the long-term costs of war for everyone involved, which includes the families, caregivers, and survivors of those who serve themselves, before making the decision to engage in any future conflict.
Kayla Williams is a former U.S. Army sergeant who was deployed to Iraq in 2003. Her most recent book is Plenty of Time When We Get Home, Love and Recovery in the Aftermath of War. Kayla, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
President Biden is headed out of town later this week, going north to Ottawa to meet with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It marks President Biden's first time in Canada since taking office. And as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, the two leaders have a lot to discuss.
It has been a while since a U.S. president made an official visit to our neighbors up north. President Trump only went briefly in 2018 for the G7 leader summit. So Biden's two-day trip with Trudeau is a long time coming.
The Canadians would like it to be a longer visit. They'd like to do more things. But it's been a kind of rush job, not because of anything other than crazy calendars.
Christopher Sands is the director of the Canada Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington. Despite the wait for this visit, Sands says Biden and Trudeau talk often because their countries are in all of the same clubs.
President Biden sees Justin Trudeau either in person or on a screen at NATO meetings, G7 meetings, G20 meetings, the summits of democracy, the Summit of the Americas, on and on, the UN General Assembly. There's quite a lot of contact.
Still, the home turf visits matter for symbolic reasons.
It's about highlighting that we get along.
Historically, U.S. presidents have used the friendly nature of the trip to partake in non-political traditions. Crowds cheered in 2009 when President Obama stopped by a market to buy a Canadian pastry called a beaver tail, which is fried dough in the shape of a long tail. And on a trip to Quebec City in 1985, President Reagan and Prime Minister Brian Mulroney sang a song on stage together. Both scenes turned out to be the lasting images from the trips, rather than any political agreements. Sands hopes to see Biden in one of these looser moments, too.
Because it goes back to the symbolic value. It's a way of saying, you know, yeah, politics are politics, but there's something about Canada I really love.
As for the politics, the White House says the president and prime minister will address supply chain woes, instability in Haiti, and supporting Ukraine. They'll also discuss Canada's investment in mining and processing critical minerals. Those are essential parts of many modern clean energy technologies, like wind turbines and electric vehicles. People will also be watching for news on migration at the Canada-U.S. border. Abdullah Daoud is the executive director of the Refugee Center in Montreal and is worried about a major increase in informal border crossings.
The idea is to ensure that these individuals have safe passage into Canada and in a more orderly fashion.
Daoud hopes Biden and Trudeau specifically discuss the Safe Third Country Agreement. That requires asylum seekers to process claims where they first arrive, the U.S. or Canada. The agreement has led to a bottleneck of migrants leaving the U.S. at an unofficial entry point in New York State. The journey, especially in the middle of winter, can be dangerous.
For me, it's not humane. And also, it just makes more sense to have a more organized pathway. Because right now, it puts a strain into our immigration system, so it only delays their ability to claim in Canada.
Trudeau says the federal government is currently renegotiating the Safe Third Country Agreement, but it's been a long process, and Daoud doesn't expect a major announcement this week. Instead, he hopes Trudeau will talk with Biden about making the U.S. asylum claim process more fair and equitable.
That way, individuals are able to claim asylum there, too. That's the main crux of it all, right? If those individuals can't claim in the United States, they're going to seek where they actually have the best chance to get safety.
President Biden is set to arrive in Ottawa tomorrow and stay through Friday. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Ukraine is about to receive a $15 billion loan. We'll dig into that decision by the International Monetary Fund just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The International Monetary Fund and Ukraine have agreed to the terms of a $15 billion loan. It would mark one of the very rare times the IMF is doing this for a country in the middle of a major conflict. Ukraine needs the money badly. They've spent aggressively on their military, and the Russian invasion has blown a hole through their economy. It's shrunk by 30% since the beginning of the war. Jeremy Zettelmeyer knows about these kinds of IMF loans. He was a deputy chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Jeremy, Ukraine is in war mode, spending lots on arms and their troops. It also costs money to fix things and rebuild. So far, how have they been able to finance all of that?
So with a combination of funding from the European Union, some of which is grant-based and lending, and of course, grants from the United States.
In your view, what does it mean that Ukraine and the IMF have agreed on this unprecedented relief loan in the midst of a conflict?
What does it mean for Ukraine? It's good for Ukraine because it will provide a framework that helps stabilize the economy. It obviously provides some direct funding from the IMF. But more importantly, it clears the way for additional concessional funding from both the Europeans and the United States. What did it take in terms of IMF policies, in terms of negotiation to get to this point?
And what did it take?
Well, as you suggested, it's a very unusual situation for the IMF. So whether it's the first time or not that the IMF has financed the country at war, I'm not sure. There was, of course, a program with Ukraine while it was having a low-level war in the East previously. That was also a result of Russian involvement, but it was not the full-scale invasion that we have right now. Ukraine's balance of payment problem, the fact that it needs more money than it can raise, does not primarily depend on Ukraine's own reform and adjustment efforts, as it would be normally the case with a country that engages in an IMF program, but it depends on the end of the war, right? So the IMF is constitutionally mandated to assist countries that have a macroeconomic stability problem, but can resolve it through some combination of IMF financing and policy within the medium term. Usually interpreted as something in the order of maybe 3-4 years maximum. And here what the IMF has done is it has stretched the duration of what it calls the medium term to the maximum that can still be justified, which is 4 years. And then the assumption essentially is that within this 4-year horizon for a program, there will be some sort of peace settlement.
Has Ukraine demonstrated it can follow through on tackling corruption?
It's making very strong efforts, I think. The jury is out, but certainly there is an awareness that this is a key point for the Western donors.
Could this loan potentially hurt the IMF standing, that it might be seen as taking sides in a war?
There's that risk. So what the IMF has done here is a very fine balance of applying the same standard to everyone, but on the other hand, adjusting that standard to fit this particular case of Ukraine. A few weeks ago, it raised its so-called normal access limits. This is the ceiling that the money that the IMF has to observe in lending to countries.
How will other nations see this loan to Ukraine? Nations like Pakistan or Sri Lanka, for example, that also badly need money.
To the extent that other nations are very risky, just like Ukraine is, they will benefit because the somewhat looser lending framework that was created for Ukraine will apply to them also. Once the policy is changed, it does apply to all countries.
Jeremy Zettelmeyer was a deputy chief economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and a director general for economic policy at Germany's Ministry for Economic Affairs. Mr. Zettelmeyer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Russia and the U.S. are cooperating in space. Russia recently launched an empty capsule to the International Space Station that was sent to replace one that was damaged last year. The new spacecraft will shuttle 3 astronauts back to Earth, 2 Russians and 1 American. As the world's Anna Kuzma reports, space remains one of the last places of U.S.-Russian collaboration.
In December, something went wrong with the Soyuz. A Russian capsule docked on the International Space Station.
This is Mission Control Houston.
White particles were spewing from the capsule.
We do not know what the source of this stream of particles is at the point.
It was a coolant leak. Officials from Russia's space agency, Roscosmos, says it was from a small meteoroid strike. While the leak didn't harm the people on board the station, that capsule was supposed to be their ride back to Earth this spring. Soon after, Russia announced it would send a new Soyuz. This all comes with the territory of working in space, says Sergei Krikalev of Roscosmos.
Space is not a safe place and not a safe environment. We have meteorite, we have vacuum, we have high temperature, and we have complicated hardware that can fail.
In a joint press conference in Moscow, NASA's ISS program manager Joel Montalbano praised his Russian counterparts.
Overall, I'll tell you that the teams have worked extremely well together, both the technical teams and the management team. It is a true testament to the partnership.
The U.S. and Russia launched the International Space Station together 25 years ago. Each module and capsule is owned by a different country, but at its core, the station is a shared mission. It's a significant place of U.S.-Russia collaboration, says Wendy Whitman Cobb. She's a political scientist at the U.S. Air Force's Air University.
This does, I think, just help demonstrate and show that there are places where we can continue to cooperate, even when relationships on the ground might turn adversarial.
Even at the height of the Cold War, the U.S. and Russia had a joint mission with Apollo and Soyuz capsules in space. But Whitman Cobb says increasingly chilly relations on the ground have seeped into space diplomacy. Several months ago, the Russian space agency announced it would pull out of the space station in the next few years and focus on its own space station, not shared.
Obviously, wanting to build your own space station is sort of a reflection of wanting to demonstrate your own power, independent power and ability in the space domain.
Whitman Cobb says it's hard to predict exactly what Russia will do. They say they want their own station, but the war in Ukraine has taken a lot of resources away from the space program.
What we do in space, what any country does in space, is really a reflection of sort of the political power dynamics that are happening here on Earth.
But for now, the lines are open.
Contact.
Contact confirmed.
And capture. Docking confirmed.
Late last month, the new Soyuz docked with the ISS.
Congratulations.
Couldn't have gone smoother from launch to docking.
Both NASA and Roscosmos celebrated on the call. For now, they're still working together and hope to bring the three astronauts back this fall. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
More stories from around the globe and beyond still coming to you ahead in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. In India, the vast neighborhood of Dharavi is described this way.
A mini city inside a city.
The dense area is smack in the middle of Mumbai. Dharavi's streets are unplanned, its sewers and electrical lines haphazard. Urban planners have long wanted to bring order to the chaos. Many others worry about what that could actually do. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. The government of New Zealand is taking romantic breakups among teenagers seriously. In a new public service announcement, it states the obvious.
Breakups suck.
Don't they just? We also hear in the PSA from a few young Kiwis trying to get up the nerve to block their exes on social media.
I'm going to have to do it, honestly. This is getting ridiculous. This is getting so out of hand. I need to sleep at night. I need to get over her, get over this hurdle.
We decided to ask Lucia O'Sullivan just how serious teenage breakups can be. She teaches psychology at the University of New Brunswick in Canada and specializes on the impact of digital technologies on relationships among adolescents and young adults. She joins us from Fredericton, New Brunswick. Lucia, teen breakups, that first bitter dose of unrequited love, it's kind of universal and they are never easy. What makes them more of a concern these days?
It's a compounded problem. We know that young people have higher rates of depression and anxiety than ever before. We also know that they're spending a good part of their lives in front of a screen or holding a screen. And we're not ultimately clear on that connection, but we know that it's contributing in some way.
Well, let's start with just how serious the teenage romantic breakup is in and of itself. From a psychological point of view, how serious is it?
Not every breakup is awful, but most people experience a breakup that is really bad. What's surprising is just how bad a breakup can be for mental health. It is implicated in, we believe, one of the leading causes of suicide and suicide attempts. And when we survey adults about the single, you know, most difficult thing they got through as a young person, by far a breakup ranks highly and often the most high in that list. It is such a common experience for young people. It's a time when they're really learning intimacy skills, working toward developing a long-term committed relationship. But that means, of course, they have to go through quite a few breakups until they get to that end point.
You mentioned earlier the screen time that teenagers spend. What does social media add to the already fraught issue of romantic breakups among teenagers?
Well, so much of their lives are with this digital interface now. It feels like they're connected, but in fact, they're having less face-to-face time often. But probably more importantly, a lot of their lives are transmitted and transparent for all the world to see. So there, many of them are used to posting about even the smallest minutiae of their life. A breakup is such an intense experience, and there is pressure for many of them to share that with their networks. Well, this is difficult because they can't always curate the perfect breakup and position that in their post as something, easy breezy. But they also can't always anticipate whether they'll get support or the type of reaction they're going to get for any information about that. Almost everybody after a breakup has trouble letting go for a little while, and that's part of the stress reaction. And the digital world just makes that even more difficult because there are so many more ways to get in contact and insight into what your ex is doing.
I mean, I've been hearing about this kind of phenomenon of breaking up on social media, nothing face-to-face. How common is that among teenagers?
The first time I came across it, I was like, oh, can you imagine the nerve? But actually, young people find that that's perfectly acceptable. That is the way to break up. In their minds, it saves face. It allows them to dodge a lot of the emotional components of it. But for the person who's being rejected, they're left at loose ends.
Do you think an outreach campaign like what they're doing in New Zealand with these public service announcements and at least paying lip service to the fact that this is a problem, is that helpful?
I think what's interesting is the recognition that a breakup is a traumatic event for most people, very distressing. Even the good ones are painful. And yes, we all think we all went through it. We all have to just weather it and get on with it and figure it out. I'm not sure that young people today have the same skill set that earlier generations have. We don't want to coddle them necessarily, but we certainly want to support them. And if there's a way to give them some insights into how to process a breakup, what to do, how to make sense of it, what signs to look for, how to support a friend going through a breakup or your kid, like warning signs, I think that would be very valuable.
Lucia O'Sullivan is a professor of psychology at the University of New Brunswick in Canada. Thank you very much.
It's lovely to talk to you.
Dara V is the largest informal settlement in Asia. It sits smack in the middle of Mumbai, India's financial capital. I've been there, and if you saw Slumdog Millionaire and Dara V's warrens of alleys packed with people, the naked electric utility wires and open sewer drains, it is not an exaggeration. Authorities say they want to turn the area into a modern township. But as Raksha Kumar reports from Dara V, it's a plan that's been in the works for a long time because it won't be so easy to execute.
Abbas Zakaria Galvani takes me up creaky wooden stairs to the third floor of his clay pot making factory. Small clay lamps sit on shelves that line the walls from floor to ceiling. Huge pots cover the floor. About half a dozen men are packing the pots in boxes. We sell in cities across the country and even export to other countries, he says. To meet the demand, he gave up the manual pottery wheel and now works with an electric one. Galvani's factory employs 22 people. It is one of thousands of small industries that exist in the tightly packed locality of Dharavi. More than 1 million people live and work in this 1 square mile area, which some urban planners often refer to as a slum cluster.
So, our family is in Dharavi. It came in 1919.
Dilwani says his family moved to Dharavi when it was nothing more than a swamp, 100 years ago. Families like his cleared out the marsh, built their homes, started small businesses that now contribute to over $1 billion in revenue every year. Informal markets pack every street of Dharavi. For 20 years now, successive governments proposed to build a modern township, complete with roads, schools, parks, hospitals, and housing enclaves. Local residents resisted the plan, fearing that fancy, gentrified buildings will have no place for them. But for real estate companies, Dharavi is a golden goose, given its strategic location. Dharavi sits in the middle of Mumbai, with the city's two main train lines passing through it. It has a huge government hospital that caters to millions of the city's poor and middle-class populations. I see lots of ambulances, about four or five ambulances. The OPD department in itself has about five stories, and there is a long queue, about 200 people queuing up for various tests and consultations.
Dharavi is a mini city inside a city.
That was architect Sandhya Naidu. She says the biggest challenge is to develop Dharavi while ensuring its people get to live and work there. And so the redevelopment plan...
It'll have to be heavily influenced by people who have the lived experience of having been in Dharavi, you know, all their lives.
That is not fully the case currently. One of India's largest conglomerates, the Adani Group, won an auction recently and will work with the government to redevelop Dharavi. The proposed plan focuses on providing housing for some residents while displacing others. Krishna Pujari is an entrepreneur who runs a travel company in Dharavi. He says residents have another concern.
Will they get a place where they can start their work or factories or business, whatever it is?
For many, Pujari says, providing homes without a space to run the business will mean a complete loss of livelihood. But it is precisely these industries that the government says need relocating. The CEO of the Dharavi Redevelopment Board, SCR Srinivas, told local media in January that Dharavi needs to develop so that it doesn't continue to add to Mumbai's pollution.
Entire sewage, everything is untreated. It is going into the Mithi River. There is no drinking water, no sanitation. There are leather industries there and textile industries which are highly polluting.
It's not just leather and textiles. Small industries contribute to pollution too. In the potter's colony in Dharavi, Meenakshi Savanya is standing near a kiln where her pots are baked before they are sold.
First Diwali festival, unke baad aata hai Marathi log ka Sankranti.
We sell our pots throughout the year during different festivals, she says. So the kiln burns most of the time, adding smoke to narrow, haphazardly built homes around it. Redeveloping Dharavi might curb such polluting practices, but ultimately, can Mumbai develop its informal settlements to actually benefit the people who live there? In the case of Dharavi, 1 million people. Back in his factory, Abbas Galvani practices a speech he has to give in the prestigious Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, on pot making. He says Dharavi gave him his identity.
To sudhar to karo. Definitely karo. Wo sudhar ko aise andaaj pe rakha karo ki jin logon ko nuksan na ho.
With time, there is bound to be change, he says. By all means, redevelop our informal settlement, but do not put us out of work. For the world, I'm Raksha Kumar in Mumbai.
Scientists in Germany have made literally a brainy discovery. It seems that the language we speak impacts how we think. Scientists at the Max Planck Institute in Germany discovered this using what's called magnetic resonance tomography. They examined the brains of native German and Arabic speakers and found that different regions of their brains were wired differently. Dr. Alfred Anwander is the study's lead researcher. He's a neuroscientist at the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences and joins us from Leipzig, Germany. Dr. Anwander, help us out first by explaining what magnetic resonance tomography is exactly.
So our participants are in a bore, in an MR scanner, and we get an image of the brain by the resonance of like the water molecules. But with this, we can get an image of the brain tissue and how the connections are formed between the different parts of the brain.
So it's a machine similar to an MRI, but really focused on the brain, yes?
Yeah, it's a normal MRI, and we measure just an image of the brain and with a special sequence which allows us to get this particular connections in the brain.
So what exactly did you see when examining the differences between German and Arabic speakers?
So we focused on the language network in the left and the right hemisphere. We know that like normal native speakers often process language mainly in the left hemisphere, but we also wanted to see how the left and the right hemisphere is connected. And when we looked on this connectivity between these language areas in the Arabic native speakers and in the German native speakers, we saw that the language areas in the left and the right hemispheres are stronger connected in the Arabic speaking people than in the German speaking people. And on the other hand, like we saw that within the like the syntax processing network, we find a stronger connectivity in the German speaking people.
So is it really about the complexity of the languages and how those languages push the brain to complete complex tasks?
Exactly. So we know that every language has specific difficulties. So some languages have a large vocabulary. So we need a lot of memory, like to understand the words. Other languages have a complex syntax, and other languages have like some important prosody or like tonal components. And all those components have to be, while we learn the language, encoded by the connectivity in the brain, like how the different nerve cells are connected.
Really fascinating. Was there a reason you chose to study German and Arabic to examine the differences in brain function?
So we choose two languages which have strong differences in their structure, in their syntax structure, and also in the way the language is composed. Of course, we took German because we did this study in Germany. And one of the reasons why we took Arabic was that we had the possibility to have very good, like homogeneous, well-educated population here in Leipzig, which didn't had any prior knowledge in German.
Do you worry, though, about what may be unanticipated problems these discoveries could lead to, like people who might draw conclusions based on what language someone speaks? I can already hear someone saying, well, of course they think like that. They speak Spanish or Swahili or whatever.
Of course, like this is very dangerous. And we had similar discussions also when brains of males and females were compared. We know that the networks in the brain influence the way information is processed. And so this is like, I think, a nice basis to look a little deeper and do further experiments in the way to see like how much also the language we learn gives you advantages for different tasks.
Yeah, go a little bit deeper with that, Dr. Anwander. How do you think this research and your findings could be applied in a practical way?
So the application is quite far away, but one of the applications could be like diseases like stroke or so. Like if you have a stroke in language areas, we have a certain way to do rehabilitation, but this is based on evidence from people speaking the language of the certain region. And if now we are aware that like people speaking different languages might have also different wirings, this means that maybe also like something like rehabilitation strategies could be adapted.
Neuroscientist Alfred Anwander is the lead researcher of a new study about how language impacts how we think. He's with the Max Planck Institute in Germany. Dr. Anwander, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A brief update now to a story we brought you Monday from Uganda. The parliament there has passed a bill that criminalizes being gay. Human rights observers say the measure goes further than similar laws in other countries. Homosexuality is criminalized in more than 30 of Africa's 54 nations. Uganda's law brings jail time for new offenses like attempted homosexuality and aggravated homosexuality. The bill was supported by nearly all of the 389 legislators present and now awaits signature by President Yoweri Museveni. LGBTQ people can now face up to 10 years in prison. Human Rights Watch said the bill violates multiple fundamental rights and criminalizes people simply for being who they are. Okay, a question for us geography nerds. What is the official language of Moldova? Up until a few days ago, the country's constitution listed it as Moldovan. An overwhelming majority of people in Moldova actually speak the Romanian language. Well, Moldova's parliament in Chisinau has now voted to remove any reference to the Moldovan language from its constitution and legislation. Some lawmakers there see the move as a not too subtle dig at Russia. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry explains.
The first time lawmakers held a vote adopting Romanian as the official language in Moldova, there were scuffles in Parliament.
Colegi, rog să continuăm.
This was just 2 weeks ago, as the Parliament's president appealed for calm, pro-Russian politicians chanted their objections. And they held up placards that read, "Do not mock the Constitution." The tiny country of Moldova is sandwiched between Romania and Ukraine, but one breakaway region, Transnistria, is controlled by pro-Russian separatists. Several pro-Kremlin lawmakers also hold seats in Moldova's parliament. A few days ago, a second language vote was held. This time, no one came to blows, and the measure was passed. But some say this decision isn't really about language at all. Iulian Groza is executive director of the Institute for European Policies and Reforms in Moldova.
There is no difference between so-called Moldovan language and Romanian language. It's the same language.
Groza says even though some people say they speak Moldovan, it's really Romanian.
It's just like trying to name English American, or like trying to name German in Austria Austrian language. Is the same.
Moldova is a former Soviet state, and Groza says the Soviet Union tried to undermine Romanian culture in Moldova by promoting the idea of a unique Moldovan language. In the breakaway region of Transnistria, Moldovan is still recognised as the official language, along with Russian and Ukrainian. The move to remove Moldovan from the law books comes at a sensitive time.
It was registered in the parliament on February 24 this year, which means exactly 1 year since the Russian attack on Ukraine.
That's Nikolai Kushkevich, who runs Rise Moldova, an investigative journalism outlet in Chisinau. Kushkevich says he doesn't know if filing the motion on the 1 year anniversary of the war was intentional, but he sees it as a concrete sign that the Moldovan government wants to distance the country from its Soviet past and move closer to European Union membership. Kushkevich is one of a consortium of European journalists who last week uncovered documents laying out plans by Russia to destabilise Moldova. The strategy was reportedly written in 2021 by the FSB, Russia's secret service. It includes proposals to make Moldova dependent on Russian gas and stir up social conflict in Chisinau. I asked Kushkevich if he was taken aback by anything in those documents.
Well, for me, actually not. Because I believe that I'm almost sure that Kremlin had such a similar document than previously.
The Kremlin has denied any knowledge of the plan. Still, for the last few months, hundreds of anti-government protesters have taken to marching through Moldova's capital. They're chanting, "Down with Maia Sandu." She's the country's pro-European president. The protesters say they're fed up with the high energy prices and inflation rates. But local authorities say the demonstrations are staged by pro-Russian lawmakers. Nadine Gogu with the Independent Journalism Centre in Chisinau says that's exactly what's going on.
Our local Moldovan investigative journalists undercover, they proved that those who protested in front of the parliament during nights, they were paid large amounts of money. They didn't even know, some of them, why they are protesting in the street.
Of all the countries bordering Ukraine, Moldova is seen as the most vulnerable. Authorities there say they've dealt with more than 400 fake bomb threats since just last summer, and that several Russian missiles intended for Ukraine have passed through Moldovan airspace. Still, Gogu says, people are less nervous today than they were a year ago or even 6 months ago.
In the fall, when we had this gas crisis and we didn't know how the winter will be, and a lot of pessimism was around. But now we saw that we survived, we managed it, and that means that with the help of foreign partners, it will be okay.
One of those foreign partners, the European Union, recently promised to spend more than $40 million on Moldova's army. Gogu says becoming an EU candidate country has helped ease Moldova's fears too, and that adopting Romanian as the official language is part of that journey. But the road to full EU membership for Moldova is probably still a long way off. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
It was a made-for-Hollywood moment, and not just because they both play for the Los Angeles Angels. Teammates during the summer, opponents last night at the World Baseball Classic Final in Miami. Mike Trout representing Team USA at the plate, Shohei Ohtani for Team Japan on the mound. The two best baseball players on earth facing each other in the championship game. Bottom of the ninth, two outs, Japan leading by one run.
Manu Manu right here. USA's captain versus Japan's captain.
First time they've ever faced each other. They've been teammates for 5 years. The best against the best.
Ohtani peered in against Trout, a three-time Major League MVP, and brought the heat.
Here's the pitch. Trout swings and misses. Pure challenge. I wouldn't want it any other way. My best stuff against your best swing.
Ohtani blew his 100-mile-per-hour fastball right past Trout twice. Trout worked the count to 3 balls and 2 strikes. You don't need to speak Japanese to understand who won the showdown. Ohtani got his Angels teammate to strike out on a nasty slider, and with that, Japan captured its third World Baseball Classic, the most of any nation since the tournament began back in 2006. Japanese fans went crazy. MSNBC captured the throngs of fans and the jubilation in Tokyo. Middle-aged businessmen wearing Team Japan uniforms, hugging and screaming. Some men reduced to tears, practically unable to speak. More than 60 million Japanese people have been tuning into these World Baseball Classic games. Ratings are still trickling in, but last night's game is believed to be the most watched game in baseball history. A great ending for a tournament that's been panned by critics for years as gimmicky. After last night, gimmicky no more. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, keep your eye on the ball. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.